Hello, and welcome back to Off the Deaton Path. My name is Stan Deaton with the Georgia Historical Society, and we welcome you to this podcast for the week of December 12th, 2018. My special guest this week is Cuffy Sullivan, the president of the League of Women Voters of Coastal Georgia. Cuffy restarted this chapter in 2016 and talks to me about her role in the League, the history behind it, and what the League of Women Voters does and doesn't do. This interview was recorded at the Jepson House Education Center in Savannah on December 5th, 2018. I hope you enjoy it. Cuffy Sullivan, welcome to Off the Deaton Path.
Thanks, Stan.
We are here to talk about the League of Women Voters, of which you are involved in. But before we do that, I want to ask you, just for the sake of our listeners who may not be familiar with you, to just give us a little bit about your background, educationally and otherwise. I know that you're not a native of Savannah, and nor am I. That counts for a lot in these quarters. But you're somebody who came here and has really made a difference in this community, I must say. In the years that I've been here, I've been very impressed with all that you do. But just tell our listeners a little bit about your background.
Oh, sure. So I grew up in Rochester, New York, and have known since the bicentennial year, 1976, that I wanted to be in historic preservation. But at the time, I didn't even know what the name of it was. There was this thing, there was history and interpretation that was really exciting to me. And it wasn't until I was graduating from high school that I got a catalog from the Savannah College of Art and Design and discovered that they had a degree in historic preservation. Most of the people I knew that did it were architects that sort of fell in through the back door into this, you know, career. So I moved down here in 83 and graduated in 86 and went on to work as a museum curator, is how I started my career. And then I found out about Main Street, which is a program of the National Trust for Historic Preservation. It's a downtown revitalization program that uses historic preservation as its main impetus. So I was in charge of some local programs here in Hinesville and then in Brunswick. And then I joined the National Trust's Main Street Center in D.C. and traveled all around the world, actually, consulting with local programs, and then moved back here in 97 to work for the Savannah Development and Renewal Authority, working on the revitalization of Broughton Street. So at that time, my husband and I renovated a loft on Broughton Street and had our first child downtown and just had this great kind of urban living, like living what I told people to do. So that was fun. And then after having a kid who was musical, and I came from a very musical family. My mother went to the Eastman School of Music and was an opera singer, and we just grew up very musically. I started looking around for musical opportunities and discovered there weren't any, so I figured I could complain for the next 20 years that there wasn't a children's choir, or I could just found one. So I co-founded the Savannah Children's Choir and was their executive director for 10 years. Now I work for Charles H. Tuning Interiors, and I do some contract work for the Georgia Historical Society and for the Savannah Philharmonic and for other nonprofits, because I'm sort of a nonprofit specialist or generalist, I guess I would really say, is I can do it all. After the last presidential election, I saw that there was a need for a little more moderated discussion on issues. And I looked around and discovered the League of Women Voters. I knew that there had been a chapter here, and it had faded, and so I thought it was maybe time to dust that off and start it. So I think what people say about me is that I'm a catalyst. You know, I'm good at starting things. So with the choir and with other, you know, I founded a women's sacred music ensemble. I mean, just if there's something in the community that doesn't exist, I figure out how to make it happen, which is something kind of cool.
Absolutely. So the League of Women Voters, there had been a chapter here in Savannah. Do you know when it existed and why it went away?
Well, it existed from about the 40s until the 90s. And from what I understand, the membership had gotten older. There was an active president who ran for office, and you can't be president and run for an office. So every time she ran for office, you know, they fade a little.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think they just kind of ran out of steam. And actually, the very first thing we did, little plug, shout out to the Georgia Historical Society, the very first thing we did is we had some of our new members come and research. There's a great box of archival information here in the archives about the league and their minutes and what they accomplished. And it really was amazing. I mean, I look at how much work it took to put together a voter guide, and to do that in a pre-computer era, that would have made me run screaming. I mean, you know. So it was, they did some impressive work. They had a great voter's guide that they published in partnership with the newspaper. They had lots of, you know, photo drives. They really did some good work over the years.
So to back up just a little bit for those of us, including me, who maybe our only touch with the League of Women Voters is growing up, I remember they sponsored presidential debates in presidential years. I'm sure they do much more than that. If you can, back up and tell us how this organization got started and what its mission is and what it doesn't do.
Right. Oh, yes, because that's as important as what it does do. So when women got the franchise in 1920, there had been two very distinct suffrage organizations that had kind of different missions as to how they thought women should get the vote. And after we got the vote, they combined because they realized that there were millions of women now that had no idea the structure and logistics on how to vote. They didn't know how to push the buttons. They didn't know how to register to vote. They didn't know anything about the candidates other than perhaps what their husbands told them or fathers. So they saw it as this grand challenge to educate all of these new voters, provide them with the tools and information they needed. So from the beginning, it's always been about that, is empowering. The mission is actually empowering voters, defending democracy. So what it's grown from in doing that is we're sort of known for the voter's guide. We're known for, you know, voter registration drives. We were known for the presidential debates. We don't do those anymore. But I think that something is that's very unique about the League, and what was very important to me when I was looking for organizations, is it has always been nonpartisan. They are absolutely committed that they do not endorse a candidate or a party. However, they do take very clear stands on issues. And this is what's very interesting, is most people know us for, you know, the lady sitting in the cafeteria registering you to vote in high school or whatever, you know. But they have this thing called the library study, where they rely on the local chapters to identify what issues are emerging and important to them. And then it goes to the state level, and the state agrees, and then it goes to the national level, and they vote on them at their biennial convention, and then they take stands. So if the League has taken a stand on an issue, you can call your representative. Hello, Senator Deaton. This is Cuffy. I'm a member of the League of Women Voters Coastal Georgia, and I believe that blah. Now, if I don't agree with that stand, I can still call my representative and say, I don't believe that, but I can't identify myself as a League member. So I think the League is known as this nationwide grassroots organization that's very powerful because of the honor of the tradition of how we study issues and come to consensus about those issues.
So let me ask you a question about that. You're nonpartisan, but you don't support candidates, but you support issues. And I'm going to play a little bit of a devil's advocate here. We are such a ideologically divided country now. It was used to be commonplace to hear people say, I support the man or the woman and not the party. But the parties have become so divided ideologically that if you support a position, you can almost figure out what that party is. So when you say you're not partisan, tell me if I'm wrong, but I don't know what sort of positions. You can give me an example of the position that you support. But if you support a position or a policy, are you in effect not supporting a candidate who supports that issue?
Well, that's a really good question. So we are seen, so I feel like the League has remained incredibly central since the beginning of the League in the 20s. We have what my daughters yell at me to not say, but we have a mom agenda. we're women. You know, we were founded by women. We are now open to all. We have many men involved in our organization, which is fantastic. But we believe in education. We believe in health care. We believe in not having our children shot up at schools. You know, so there are many issues that are central to women and families that have evolved through the years that we take positions on. You know, we don't believe in polluting the environment. I mean, there's just many broad issues that we do take stands on because we're women, or, you know, and founded by women. So what's interesting is if you went back to the 70s, you would have thought that the League of Women Voters was a very Republican organization, because at the time, those issues that the Republican Party was espousing were absolutely ones that we supported and stood for and believed in. So I feel like you can't see me on the radio, but I'm waving my arm on a little meter here, that the league has always been in the center, but the parties have moved, you know, their center has moved back and forth through mm-hmm. the years. But we've remained pretty strongly committed to these kind of issues, public school education, you know, healthcare, equal pay for equal work. I mean, all these kinds of things that are important to us.
Does the league nationally allow local chapters like the Coastal Georgia chapter to make up its own mind? Or does it hand down national directives that say, we support, I'm going to make this up, we support research for stem cell research. Mm-hmm. And so we, you know, because some communities, by their very nature, may be more conservative and who might not like that. So do they let you make up your own mind, or that they hand down directives?
Well, their stands emanate up from the local community. Okay, they don't come from the top down at all. Everything comes from the local chapters. Mm. All right, so that's how it percolates up. That's why we talk about lobbying through the front door. I mean, everyone knows where we're coming from. They know the history of our research. They know, you know, the years it takes to study these issues. So I would say that there is nothing handed down from national that hasn't already been handed up to them in the first place, if that makes sense, because that's where it all comes from. What's challenging, and I discovered this attending our last biennial in June in Chicago, is that something that might be very strongly felt against in one community, let's say there's some community in California experiencing issue A, we might in coastal Georgia be absolutely on the opposite side of it. And so there is flexibility in that as well. We have, our state has positions as well that we can use to kind of more customize what's pertinent to our local community.
So different chapters may be on opposite sides of
right,
the issue.
Right, just depending on how that issue affects them. Exactly.
And do you take issues on things that you see going on a national level, like immigration, that may or may not be affecting, and we can presume in the 21st century almost every community is affected by things that once seemed national, like immigration policy. Mm-hmm. Do you just take a stance on an issue because you want your voice out there, or our policy, versus something that really directly impacts a community?
That's a good question, Stan.
Is there any value in that, I guess?
Yeah. There is. I think where this is most useful is not even to our chapter, but to our members. If there's something that they're passionate about, mm-hmm. we encourage our membership and all citizens to communicate with their representatives. That's their job. You know, that's part of being a citizen.
No matter what their stance is.
No matter what your stance is.
Right.
If you agree that immigration needs to be fixed and the league has a stand on that says immigration needs to be fixed, you can call your representative and say, not only do I think that immigration needs to be fixed, but I'm a member of the League of Women Voters and it needs to be fixed. If you think immigration is just fine the way it is, you are still welcome to call your representative and say, I think immigration's fine, don't do anything about it. But you can't say, and oh, by the way, I'm a member of the League of Women Voters, because the league has already taken a position that immigration needs to be fixed. Mm. But we don't care. Just call your representative. What we find is that it helps when you also have this national position with an organization who they know who they are and they know how well researched this position is. It's also helpful for you to have that in your arsenal as you call your representative.
But really what you want is engagement and encouraging engagement in the political system, even if what people are engaged in or believe in
might be different. We don't care. Just call. Just vote. We don't care who you vote for. Mm-hmm. Just vote.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You mentioned men involved. Are men, can men join, or are they just involved in administrative?
They are absolutely involved and welcome to join. In fact, that was so surprising to me, again, to go to the national conference this past June and see so many men that were presidents of their local chapters, that were involved in the organization. So we are, first and foremost, a membership organization. So anyone can join. We have individual memberships, we have family memberships, we have student memberships. So anyone can be a part of it simply by joining and paying a membership fee.
You pay your dues and you're in.
You pay your dues, you're in. We don't care. We don't ask for a DNA test. We just, you know, watch out.
So in reality, it sounds like it's a league of men and women voters.
Yes,
or women
is.
And men voters.
Yes.
But it retains that name.
It retains the name.
It would be inaccurate, I think. Tell me. Again, playing devil's advocate, to say if people sort of have a knee-jerk reaction and they just hear the name and they don't know anything about it and they say, oh, the League of Women Voters, it must be a feminist organization. Would you describe it that way? Or would
Ooh.
You? And that may be a loaded question because that's a whole different kind of avenue.
It is.
Or would you just say that you take stances, as you said, that probably just engage women? Of course, all of us have a stake in
exactly.
the things you've mentioned. But.
Yes, exactly. So I wouldn't say we are necessarily feminist in what that has become defined as. I mean, if you think that, you know, paying women equally for the work they do is feminist, or that, you know, women shouldn't be dying in childbirth, you know, then maybe we are feminist. Mm-hmm. But I think we're... Familyist, I think, is maybe perhaps a better term. And then there are many things that are kind of non-gender related that we also take stands on, you know, the environment and money and politics and fair voting practices and standards and so forth. So none of those are particularly gender related. Mm-hmm. They're everybody.
So to reiterate that mm-hmm. point, you're mm-hmm. not just advocating for issues that might seem important to women. You're advocating for issues that are important to
citizens.
Citizens mm-hmm. and engagement in the process.
Yes, absolutely.
So what's it been like now? You said you got involved after the 2016 election. How did you start the chapter? Did you have to contact the national organization and say, hey, can I get a handbook? How do we do this?
Well, I'm someone who sadly tends to ask forgiveness and not permission. So I used social media and just said, hey, let's get together and talk about, you know, show up for coffee at this time and this date and this place. And eight women showed up, eight women who I didn't know showed up. And then we thought, this is great. Now let's have something in the evening so we could get the non-working women. And we had something and 50 women showed up. And then we had another event and 200 people showed up. So we figured there was enough interest. And so we contacted our state league in Atlanta. And they were very helpful. They had a sort of handbook of what you need to do to get started. And the first phase is you're called a member at large, or an MAL unit. So when you joined, since there wasn't a local entity with which to join, you joined the state level. So you became a member, and by state, you're also, by virtue of that, you're a member of the National League. So we're now on a list somewhere. And then when there were enough of us that had joined, and we filled out some other paperwork, then we were able to join, and at the June biennial, we were announced as the newest league. So that was very exciting. So we had, in a very short amount of time, gotten it all done so that we could be an official chapter of the league.
Has it been fulfilling? Have you enjoyed it? Do you see it carrying out the goals that you thought when you got engaged two years
ago? You know,
ago?
We have done so much more than that I just can't even believe it sometimes. So we have, what's been fulfilling for me is the board of directors I work with are just some of the smartest women I've ever met in my life. And the chance to get to work with them and get to know them has been so, I'm a little verklempt about it actually, it has been so meaningful to me. The volunteers that have joined have just been unbelievable with their commitment and the work that they do. Just this past year, we've registered over 750 voters, visited more than a dozen high schools, been to hundreds of community events where we've had a booth set up to just provide information. We've launched a new website that has a complete voter toolkit there, like absolutely everything you need to know about how to vote, how to register, where to vote, when to vote, what the, you know, candidates are. We have a nonpartisan voter's guide that describes the candidates and links you to their websites and talks about their positions. And the fact that we've pulled this off in less than 2 years is just profound. We have a great membership database and members that come to meetings. We have 10 programs throughout the year, as well as some summer events. And we have just had an incredibly exciting program year so far. We had we've had three candidates forums that were sold out. I mean, for free, but, you know, sold out. And we've had all kinds of information sessions. We had a Courts 101 where people could kind of everything you needed to know about the court system and just didn't know how to ask, with the current DA and Meg Heap, and then the former DA, Spencer Lawton. We have a program coming up on the 13th at the JEA at 7 p.m. called The State of the Georgia Coast. So we've got Megan DeRozier's coming up. She's with 100 Miles, just to talk about what the threats and challenges and successes are with Georgia's coastline, because there just are many environmental things out there. We're having a fabulous Women's History Month program this coming March, where partners across the community are just, we're kind of amalgamating all their programs together in one easy-to-find place. Everything from resources here at the Georgia Historical Society on women to a concert featuring women's composers done by a local Renaissance ensemble. I mean, just lots of cool things coming up with that. So I think we've exceeded everything I dreamed about. I mean, we've really pulled together a respected, known, informative organization that I'm incredibly proud of.
One of the things you mentioned at the beginning as being motivation for why you wanted to do this was civil discourse. And so I would ask, what are typical meetings like? When you think of a New England town hall meeting, is it individuals standing up and simply voicing an opinion as if it were a meeting, city council or town hall? Or is it, do you invite candidates, do you invite sitting politicians to come and just talk about what they're doing or what they hope to do, and then members maybe stand up and ask them questions and engage them? Is it civil? What is a meeting like?
Well, we have our general membership meetings, our annual meeting, and those are very kind of Robert's Rule of Order. And then we have programs, which are these informative meetings that I was describing, you know, the Courts 101, the State of the Georgia Coast, and those are open to everybody so that it's not necessarily kind of a membership thing. And then we have our forums. Those are intensely fabulous examples of civil discourse, because that's something we believe in so strongly. In fact, we've actually had some training in civil discourse. We've had a meeting where the speaker talked about what civil discourse was, how to have it, what are resources, why it's important, because I think that was my main motivation for starting the league, is I felt that civil discourse in sort of the town square had just gone into hibernation, and that living particularly in a community like Savannah, where we are very courtly and kind to one another, that we needed to continue to build that muscle. That just because you might think differently than I do doesn't mean that I demonize you or hate you. But we need to find ways to communicate without civil undiscourse, I guess is maybe how I would say that.
Screaming at each other. Or calling each other names. Or interrupting. I mean, part of it is just simply letting other people speak.
Yeah, exactly. And letting them feel heard. Mm-hmm. So we are very committed to this. So I probably, to answer your question, Stan, the forums would be the best example of that. So these are moderated forums. The two candidates are there. The moderator asks the question of both of them. There is no hooting and hollering from the audience. If there is, we politely ask them to leave. And as a result, our forums have been so well received, because people felt like, oh my gosh, I actually got to hear the candidate and what the candidate had to say without everyone screaming and yelling and protesting and all that kind of stuff. And so even the people screaming and yelling were happy to hear, to have an opportunity to hear. I think that's something we're just so sorely lacking, is nobody listens. You know, you're either reinforcing the point that you already have in your mind, or you're against it and I hate you. I mean, so yeah, I'm being a little overly dramatic here, but, you know, just these are the people that want to represent us. Let's hear what they have to say and how what they think is important and how they would represent us. So those have been incredibly important to us.
Let me ask you a question. Because you're so involved, this is what your organization is so focused on, voter engagement. You mentioned registering voters. We just came through an election here in Georgia where the whole issue of both, depending on which side you're on, either voter suppression or voting illegalities mm-hmm. became a hot button issue, whether it was in the Secretary of State's race, which went into a runoff, or, of course, in the governor's race, mm-hmm. and it lingered for weeks. Mm-hmm. Did that in any way, does that issue and did this particular election bring the league into focus either in a good or a bad way, or put you in a place maybe you didn't want to be, or did you simply not engage whatsoever after the fact? You're all about getting people mm-hmm. to be engaged, and then mm-hmm. when the accusations begin to fly, does the league stand back and just not take part? How does that work?
I think the state league had... I think that the state league took a position on the voting issue because it really was pretty stark. You know, they were involved in the Randolph County. I think that was the one where they closed several polling places and they took an amicus brief or, you know, something there. That is something that I believe is kind of percolating up right now through the local communities because the state actually sent out kind of a survey and said, how did it look in your town? You know, were the lines long? Were the machines working? Were, you know, how were there problems? So that we can take a more learned stand moving forward. You know, it was embarrassing to see how the rest of the nation looked at our elections, no matter what side, you know, you feel. I think we know that there's probably not a lot of illegal voting going on. I mean, I think that's been pretty well proven. But what we have seen is that there's voting seems to be more difficult than it ought to be. And so I think that's something that moving forward we're going to be very involved with. So I know that our local league has been in contact with the local board of elections, that we have presented a plan to them that we're waiting to hear back on of how we can be involved. You know, what we found out is just last year over 100 poll workers retired, knowledgeable, skilled poll workers retired. And so they were very short-staffed. There's different things we can do right now. It's a 12-hour shift. And as you know, most of our poll workers are already retired people, and that's just a long shift.
So they're volunteers.
They get paid.
They get paid,
you
okay,
know,
see?
Kind of gas money, but I mean, it's not a lot, but... You know, it's something.
By whom?
By the Board of Elections.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. and then one of the suggestions was let's make it 2 6-hour shifts. And for whatever reason, that never happened. I think something we're looking at is working with local businesses to say, hey, big local business that has 3,000 employees, how about you allow, kind of almost like jury duty, how about you allow your workers to go work with this, or service clubs? I think that would be a great idea for, you know, a Rotary or a Kiwanis to say, hey, we're as our service project, we're going to take this day and go get trained and work as poll workers, you know, to help this process. So I think there's lots of stuff we can do. You know, our machines are a problem. But I think everybody knows that, and I know that the new Secretary of State will be looking at that. What I discovered, again, in June is that there's federal money out there to help purchase local machines that Georgia has not taken advantage of, sadly. So I think it's certainly not the elephant in the room. I think we're all aware that there's a problem and that there is a balance between making it easy for those who have every right to vote to allow them to vote.
Let me ask you this question, because just to understand the process of how the your local chapter works and how you arrive mm-hmm. at a decision. You just said, I think we can all agree that voting is more difficult than it should be. I will imagine that there are people who would say, no, it's not. How, and so is there internal debate? Do you literally take a vote at a meeting to see whether the local chapter mm-hmm. wants to send a message that voting is, quote, too difficult? Or if there are people who say, oh, no, it's as it should be, everyone should do X, Y, Z, do you then just go, okay, that we're not going to take a position, or our position shifts to where we say it's not too difficult? Do you see what I'm asking?
Oh, absolutely. We do that as part of our annual meeting.
Okay.
At our annual meeting, we alert our members in advance. We say, here are the positions that we are going to take for the next year, and the membership votes on that at the annual meeting in May. So that's how we do it. And then that goes up to the state level, and then they vote on it at their annual meeting. And then it goes up to the national level, and they vote on it at their biennial. So it's kind of like the Schoolhouse Rock, it's I'm just a bill.
Right.
It's the same process, that same grassroots process.
And so is it fair to say that the policy positions that the league endorses might be perceived as conservative and might be liberal? That there are some positions that this group of politicians might support and others that they would oppose, and then maybe on the left there are others. Is it really down the middle, or do you, and maybe I'm asking you a question you can't answer, that the positions you tend to support, do they often have bipartisan support, or do they tend to be, as it turns out, pretty ideological?
No, it's interesting because in the very same list of positions, one group would consider that very much aligned with theirs, and so would the other.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just depending on the issue.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think we are necessarily associated with any one ideology. We're really across the board because it's about the individual positions. It's not the candidate. It's not the party. It's not the ethos. It's the actual issue, and that can be a very different thing for each individual issue.
Mm-hmm. Well, I applaud you on all the work that you've done in this community and the time that you've been here since 1983. I know you went away and you came back, but of all the things you've been involved in, you have made a tremendous difference. I applaud you for starting this chapter and hope and wish you well in the work that you continue to do, and I can't thank you enough for coming on the podcast to talk about
it. Thanks, Stan. And to learn more about the league, visit www.lwvcga.org and learn how to vote and learn about your candidates and learn how to get involved.
Terrific.
Thanks.
That concludes our interview with Cuffy Sullivan, the president of the League of Women Voters of Coastal Georgia. The interview was conducted at the Jepson House Education Center in Savannah on December 5th, 2018. The hardest working engineer in show business, now the czar of our Tallahassee office, as well as the captain of the GHS under 40 soccer team, is our very own Brendan Cannonball Crellin. Our mailman this week and every week is Crimson Tide fan extraordinaire, one Gary F. Taylor, born and raised, that's right, who is away this week attending the Pepper Jelly Festival in Thomaston, Alabama, but he promises to be back next week. Our legal counsel this week and every week is provided by the law offices of Gallipo and Taylor, where their motto is, "Come to us when experience doesn't matter." Catering this week provided by Hagee's House of Tacos, home of Big Al's Well Done, Bombing Run, Trust Fund, Second to None, Harpoon Gun, Is That a Man Bun, Ain't We Got Fun, Not to Be Outdone, Mother Nature's Son, It'll Hit You Like a Thompson Submachine Gun, Drippy Enchilada. If you have an iPhone, you can find our podcast at the App Store or on the podcast app on your phone. If you have an Android, look for us at Google Play. Tell your friends and family because every vote counts. You can find out everything about the Georgia Historical Society at georgiahistory.com and the Georgia History Festival at georgiahistoryfestival.org. Please also check out my blog and similarly electorally pleasing podcast at deatonpath.georgiahistory.com. If you have any comments about this show or about life in general and how much you enjoy it, drop me a line at sdeaton@georgiahistory.com. As always, thank you for listening. We hope you'll come back next week. So long, everybody.